Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. A man who has both extraordinary credentials in U.S. intelligence and brings an awful lot of the just, well, human kind of it to bear in his day-to-day work after his service to our country in the uniform of the United States Navy has been completed, is our guest, I'm very pleased to say, for this full hour. His name is Captain James Fennell, United States Navy retired. Jim was, among other things, in the course of his distinguished career in naval intelligence, the chief of intelligence for the U.S. Pacific Fleet. He has been studying closely, thinking hard about, monitoring assiduously, and reporting with very, very considerable impact on what the Chinese have been doing over this decade or two to increase their capacity and their use of unrestricted warfare against our country. He has been a member of our Committee on the Present Danger, China. He is a senior fellow at the Geneva Center for Security Policy, not to be confused with ours in Washington, D.C., but he is a great friend and a very, very valued contributor to this program always, and it's really a delight to have a chance to do a deep dive with him once again. Jim, welcome back to our program, Secure Freedom Radio.
Hey, Frank, it's great to be with you and your audience. Thank you for the invitation.
Super. Let me ask you first and foremost, Jim, to walk us through the substance, the background, and the implications of this pronouncement that was issued by Xi Jinping, the dictator of China, and Vladimir Putin, the dictator of Russia, last week on the margins of the opening ceremonies of the, well, we call them the Genocide Games in Beijing. A strategic alliance seems to have been rolled out there. What did you make of it, and what should we all be thinking comes next?
Yeah, Frank, I think the announcement or the proclamation from both Xi and Putin demonstrate what I believe is a growing relationship between the two nations and the two leaders who see the West, both in America and Europe, in a position of weakness. And they're taking advantage of what you could call a vacuum in leadership from the West. And they're recognizing that they have a chance to achieve goals that they have for consolidation of power in their nations internally, and also territorial desires that they have, whether they're pipelines for Russia in the Ukraine, or whether they're, the restoration that Xi talks about for the great rejuvenation of China. And so this 5,000-word statement has been examined. Lots of people have been talking about it. Our national security advisor of this administration was on the Sunday shows talking about it and trying to downplay it. But and others try to downplay it as well and say it's just a temporary marriage of convenience and that they have a historic distrust between the two nations. And while I don't disagree with those historic perspectives, the simple fact of the matter is that Russia and China are working closely together today across the spectrum of levers of power, whether it's diplomatic coercion, whether it's direct military threats like we're seeing Russia, surrounding the Ukraine today and threatening the Baltics and threatening Poland, or the threats that the PRC has made by taking control of the South China Sea and harassing any foreign military that goes into the South China Sea, and their obvious threats against both Japan and Taiwan in the East China Sea and in Taiwan proper. And so marriage of convenience notwithstanding, there are practical implications of this alignment. And the two leaders took advantage of the Olympics. I think it's interesting, some of the people that I've talked to and that I respect really seem to believe that the statement, the 5,000-word statement, looks to have been largely written by Chinese authors and agreed to by Russia. And so that's it gives you a sense that China is the dominant force in this relationship, but they're still... There's still a mutual benefit there. They're both able to help each other. China, needs certain things from Russia, energy, obviously. They need still technology in certain areas. They still have issues with some of their military technology, like jet engines. They need help in nuclear arena when it comes to maybe nuclear propulsion for submarines. They need it in terms of maybe command and control issues, satellites and technology there. So there's benefits that they both can provide to each other. Russia can produce food for China. So there's a symbiotic relationship there where they both benefit. And I think those that try to downplay it and say there's nothing to worry about are doing a disservice to our nation and our own national defense.
It's whistling past the graveyard, it seems to me, to use an old expression. A couple of things that I want to just tease out there, Jim. I've described this as one of the most cynical, as well as one of the most ominous documents, arguably going back to, the Nazi-Soviet non-aggression pact. And to your point about, the asymmetries between the two powers here, it's kind of reminiscent of Hitler with Xi as the Führer, perhaps, and Putin as a Mussolini kind of figure in this partnership, albeit with nuclear weapons in substantial quantity and ambitions. The problem that it seems to me we are failing to contemplate, as you've indicated, by expecting that over time these guys will be once again at each other's throats, is they can do an immense amount of damage in the meantime. And that seems to be the thing that is so particularly ominous. And Jim, just to talk about some of these collaborative initiatives you've mentioned in technology cooperation, for example, sharing of engine technology, nuclear submarine propulsion systems, satellites, and so on. To the extent that China is made a more formidable adversary by this partnership in that form, and also simply by virtue of the fact that these guys can help tie down the West, if this so-called full partnership, translates into mutual support for each other's aggression, this would be a very dangerous development indeed. Do you see that, particularly that cooperation, at least having each other's back at a minimum? For example, if Putin decides to go into Ukraine or Xi decides to take on Taiwan.
Yeah, I do, and I heard as I mentioned, our national security advisor go on TV on Sunday and said, because the 5,000-word statement doesn't have the word Ukraine in it, we can therefore take a solace that Xi Jinping and the Chinese Communist Party would not support Vladimir Putin and the Russian military invading Ukraine. That's an asinine way of thinking. It defies all the other, the rest of the statement and the rest of the actions that we've seen between these two leaders over the last decade. And so
even the statement that very explicitly supports Russia's position on NATO,
correct,
which is arguably the rubric within which this Ukraine crisis is developed.
Right. So I get a little bit agitated with this kind of, I think I've used this analogy before. It's like the princess in the pea. We have leaders in our national security arena in Washington that, they'll look for one little pea in a stack of 100 mattresses and say, ah, there it is. I found the one little thing. I felt that pee. And you're like, well, what about all the other 100 mattresses and all the overwhelming data that counters your assessment? That just gets tossed out. And so I think we're doing this again, and we've done it before, and it's to our own detriment. And when you recognize that this is really a serious threat, then you have to go back and reassess, well, we have a couple of options. We can either try to fight both China and Russia, or we can figure out how can we divide them. And this is the issue that we seem not to be willing to accept in America's leadership circles in Washington, is how can we split China and Russia? And that just seems to be a topic that's not in this administration's realm of conception, even though the previous administration was actively working towards that.
I want to come back to both of those points, Jim, in the course of our conversation with you here over this hour, the quality and limitations of our leadership, and also this failure to understand that fracturing this alliance ought to be a paramount priority for American policy. But just to stay with sort of the current threat assessment, and I don't think there's anybody better than you in terms of evaluating specifically what the Chinese have been doing. So I want to get at that in a bit more detail. You've mentioned a couple of areas in which they have some technical shortcomings or at least desires to enhance their capabilities. How would you assess today the state of the Chinese military relative to our own, both quantitatively and, very importantly, qualitatively?
Yeah, it's a tough question. I mean, you can't make a broad sweeping statement across the board in some ways, because in a way, the United States clearly is still superior across the totality of military capabilities. But when it comes to the arena of what China is desiring to do, to take Taiwan and to take the Senkakus and to even fight India on its border to restore what they claim is their territorial integrity, the Chinese then have the advantage, I think, in many ways. For instance, in what I focus on is the naval arena in the East China Sea and South China Sea, in between those first and second island chains. We just had an admiral from the OPNAV staff, head of surface warfare, N-96. He came out and said, we're not equipped to, confront the Chinese Navy in terms of anti-ship cruise missiles, that they're superior to us. They have a larger magazine. They have more missiles, longer range missiles, supersonic missiles, while ours are still subsonic. And they have hypersonics as well. But in naval-to-naval engagement, the Chinese Navy is superior, both in terms of numbers of ships, terms of the quality of their ships in many ways, in like the Type 055 Renhai class cruiser that's got 112 VLS tubes that can launch a YJ-18, anti-ship cruise
vertical
missile.
Vertical launch system.
Right, vertical launch system. And so they're very capable to fight the fight that they need to fight. Now, some people would say, well, that doesn't mean anything for the rest of the world. And I would simply say, well, people said that they'd never have that advantage that they have today inside the first and second island chain. Who's to say that in 10, 20 years, based on everything they tell us they're going to do, based on the prioritization that they use for their asset allocation, that they're going to continue to build what they want to have, which is the global Navy that displaces the United States Navy. So the strategic trend line is still in favor of China.
And your point, Jim, is, I think, so critical here. It's not just that they have more ships than we have in the region. They're obtaining more ships than we have now globally, and that the quality of those ships, the quality of the armaments on those ships, is now such that even senior naval persons in our Pacific Command are acknowledging that we are currently unable to contend with the firepower of these various Chinese forces. This is something that it's hard to overstate the implications in the region, because it is of such importance to us, both strategically and economically. Talk a little bit about that, Jim. You mentioned the South China Sea in particular. How does this figure in the calculus of the Chinese Communist Party in terms of what it thinks it can now get away with in the region? Might it include military conquest of Taiwan and possibly in the not too distant future?
Yeah, I think as I've said in previous shows here, and I've written about, China is on a timeline to achieve the Chinese Communist Party's goals of what the G has called the Great Rejuvenation. It's also the Great Restoration of the territory that they believe is rightfully theirs. And over the course of the decade of 2010 to 2020, they were essentially able to acquire the South China Sea. And they built 7 artificial islands, 3 of which are the size of Pearl Harbor, that have 10,000-foot runways, and that can, you know, manage and home port, have major combatants pull pier side and get refueled, rearmed, and they can even take up their aircraft carriers and certainly their submarines, nuclear submarines, and whatnot. So they have these 3 major installations surrounded by 4 other installations that are largely filled with, intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance types of facilities that provide a threat warning bubble over those major bases. So they control the southern portion of the South China Sea. So any U.S. aircraft carriers or amphibious ready groups that would come from U.S. East Coast across the Mediterranean, through the Indian Ocean and through the Strait of Malacca, that would, which would take some time, oh, by the way, those forces would be stymied by a force package that would be down there that could clearly go toe-to-toe with a single aircraft carrier group, or even a U.S. Navy aircraft carrier group, or 2 or 3. That's the size of what the Chinese have down there in the southern portions of the South China Sea. They've also acquired, kind of access to, they built up Hainan Island, they built up Woody Island, and they took essentially possession of Scarborough Shoal. While there's no facility there, they're in control of that water space. So if you look at the South China Sea as kind of a triangle, they've got the entrance of the south of the Taiwan Strait kind of under their control. They've got the entrance of the Bashi Channel under their control, and they've got the southern entrance through the Strait of Malacca and Singapore under their control. So they control the South China Sea on a daily basis. Now, we still operate there, but since October of 2015, every time the U.S. Navy enters the South China Sea, the Chinese and U.S. Air Force enter the South China Sea, they are being not only monitored, but they are being shadowed by PLA Navy, PLA Air Forces, and they're being told, you can't be here because you didn't ask permission. And it's not just the U.S. Navy. They're doing it to all foreign navies. So recently, the Germans just had a frigate go through there, the frigate Bern. It was shadowed while it was transiting through the South China Sea. So China has sent the signal to the world that while they may have not made a diplomatic claim to the entirety of the South China Sea, a de jure claim, they've de facto claimed it. And what that gives them is an assurance that they can control that strategic body of water whenever they need to. And in the event of attack on Taiwan, it gives them a whole new ability to surround Taiwan. I mean, before, when the United States still had the majority of power, military power in the South China Sea, going back to when I was in uniform, China couldn't count on that southern route into Taiwan. Now they have it. And it's not just a southern approach. They go over Philippines, and now they can attack from the east as well. So this is of prime importance that they've been able to transform this in that 10-year period. And the next 10 years is for them to say, we're going to either diplomatically or through economic coercion or information warfare, we're going to get the government of Taiwan to concede to us and say that they're part of the PRC, or we're going to go and take it by physical force. And they're now fully capable of doing that. And we have senior leaders in the U.S. Admiral Davidson last March of 2021 said he thought it would be by 2027. You've had the Taiwan Minister of Defense say 2025. I thought it's this 2020 to 2030 is the most important decade of our lives in terms of this region. And it looks like it's increasingly likely that the PRC and Xi are going to move even earlier.
That's my fear. Jim, you've given us a wonderful tutorial on a lot of real estate or ocean space, at least, that I think most Americans are not conversant about. And the degree to which it is marking the sort of inexorable progression, the trajectory, as you put it, I think, of the Chinese Communist Party's military arm, the People's Liberation Army, the People's Liberation Army Navy, to be able to exercise dominion over those areas. And it may be de jure, as you say, it may be de facto. But either way, at will, it increasingly appears they will be able to interfere with others' use of those waters and airspace. And as you say, Jim, of course, it's not just shadowing military forces or telling military forces they need to have permission to use those areas. This is a marker they're putting down, as I understand it, with respect to commercial shipping as well. And just give us a sense of the scale of the use of those important waters and, as I say, airspace by various world, you know, powers, commercial interests.
Yeah, well, Frank, the South China Sea is one of the most important waterways in the world. It's akin to the Persian Gulf in terms of its economic importance with oil. In terms of world trade, and the South China Sea provides somewhere annually around $3 trillion worth of goods, or $3 to $5 trillion worth of goods go through the South China Sea. And that's why you've seen, British, UK aircraft carriers, French aircraft carriers, German frigates, Australians. You have a Dutch been out there, Canadians. You see an international representation by these nations because they're concerned that in the eventuality that China wants to cut off commercial trade and send a signal. I mean, they've done it economically against South Korea and against Australia. They've put embargoes and things of that nature. But the Chinese are actually planning to say, if we want to stop somebody from trading and bringing their goods in, we can have the capability to do that if we so desire. And they haven't done that yet, and they say that they would never do that, but we know that the Chinese Communist Party, when they open their mouth, they're lying. And we've seen them lie on so many other things.
Their lips are moving.
Right. So their lips are moving. We know that it's not true. I mean, that's kind of a joke, but in really serious terms, we know they do not comply with agreements that they've made. And when they promise to do something, they break those promises over and over and over again. In 2002...
And Jim, yeah, you've been very clear about a prime example of this, which you've, again, just laid out for us, and that is their promise not to militarize those South China Sea manufactured islands, for example, which has given rise to some of these very ominous capabilities. And I guess one of the things I just wanted to drive home here is that we may have a presence, and when I say we, I mean all of the nations that you've just described, the free world, if you will, but it is a fleeting one in those waters. And what the Chinese have done is establish a permanent presence and a permanent ability to project power and, as I say, exercise dominion over it. And it's the difference, as Mark Twain used to say, between lightning and lightning bugs, you know, whether you're actually able to exercise that kind of control. Jim, let me back the lens up one more time, because I think this is a good segue into the larger point, which, again, you've been at the forefront of helping us understand. When we're dealing with the Chinese Communist Party and its military capabilities, that's not the full extent by any means of the danger we're facing from this quarter. Talk us through a little bit, if you would, and I think this audience is pretty conversant about it, but I would like to just, again, amplify it against the backdrop of what you've just described now in terms of the enhancing kinetic options for the Chinese by asking you to address the unrestricted warfare they've been waging against us for decades in a whole host of other areas, and where that stands at the moment as well.
Right. I mean, you just look at what's occurred in the last 2 years with the virus that came from China and the controls that China has put in place in their own nation, where you cannot go anywhere without having your smartphone and having an app that will either give you a green light or a red light, allowing you to enter any establishment, to leave your apartment, to go to the store, to go to the doctor, to go on a train, to go on a plane, to visit another city. That's been in place now for 2 years. And there's been some good reporting on it. China Uncensored just had a nice video. There's been some good reporting on it just recently. And what I like to tell people, because I sit over here in Europe, is we think that that's crazy and it could never happen in a free country. And I was in January up in Germany, and at Hamburg, and I could not go into a retail store without showing proof of whether I had the vaccine, whether I was recovered from it, or I had a negative test. I had to show something, and I preferred to keep a paper copy of my proof of my status to allow me to go into a restaurant, to go into my hotel that I was staying at. But the people of Hamburg had a local app called Luca, and the whole city was using it. It was ubiquitous. Now, they didn't force it on us, but the point is, it was everywhere, and it was so simply accepted by the people, and it's the same story in France. They have a similar one. They have one in Italy. The whole EU's adopted this, and certain parts of America have. New York City, we read about.
It's essentially, I think your point, the precursor to, if not a pretty high fidelity replication of the social credit system of China. And to the extent that it is a triumph for the Chinese that they have managed to institute that here as well as you say, elsewhere around the world.
And it's going to control every aspect of your life. It monitors everything that you do, from who you come in contact with, who you, what you buy, what you read, every facet of your life. And the app has, you know, the capability to listen to what you're saying, listen to who you're talking to, like this conversation, everything. So it is 1984 in reality.
Steroids, yeah. Our guest is Captain James Fennell, United States Navy retired, naval intelligence professional of the First Order, a man who has continued to serve his country with great distinction, albeit from abroad, by continuing to monitor and acquaint the rest of us, notably through a wonderful Google group he calls Fennell Red Star Risen, about what the Chinese Communist Party is up to and what it means for us. And we always delight in having the opportunity to visit with him about all of this. Jim, as I recall, you are helping us as a fellow of our Center for Security Policy as well, which we deeply appreciate, and especially your acumen on the full magnitude of the Chinese threat. And I just wanted to invite you to talk us through a couple of these other facets of it, because I think the American people have been mugged by reality in the form of this, well, I think, biological warfare attack against us, COVID-19. But we've been subjected as well to economic warfare attacks for decades. And talk a little bit about that, if you would, especially in the context of the supply chain problems that we're now confronting and what might become of us if they get intensively worse.
Right. Frank, essentially, China has the control over what we as Americans and Europeans need to live. The clothes that we buy, in many cases, some of the food that we buy, but the tools that we use, the clothes that we wear, I mean, the utensils that we need, the so much, and the, you know, computers, obviously, and that kind of thing, they're all coming back to us shipped from China. And China can use that to regulate our behavior if they so choose. Now, people would argue, well, then they would lose out that money and it would be economically devastating for China. Well, that's where China is moving into another arena, which is they are moving into, I think, to essentially take over the world's currency from the dollar with their own currency. And they're starting this with their digital yuan, their digital currency. And it's now being rolled out in the Olympics. And so if you're inside the bubble there at the Beijing Olympics, no matter what country you're from, no matter what nationality you are, you cannot purchase anything in that area with cash. Everything is done on this app again, and it's with their digital currency. And so, you know.
And how, Jim, just how to stay with that for a minute. How does that play into the kind of social control that you were just describing is inherent in the rest of this social credit system of the Chinese Communist Party?
Right. Because essentially all of your wealth becomes in this digital currency that is monitorable and controllable by the government. And if you don't do the things that they tell you to do, if you say the wrong things, if you utter the wrong words, if you look at the wrong website, then they're going to say, oh, sorry, this month, instead of getting 100% access to your retirement or your salary, we're only going to give you 70% access of your funds because of the bad things that you did. I mean, this is where they're at.
And you may actually also be told what you can spend your money on.
Correct.
As well.
Exactly. You cannot purchase this because it's not healthy for you. And this is...
It's mind-boggling, truly, as you say, Orwellian in the extreme. But Jim, just to move on, this question of the hollowing out of our industrial capabilities, our ability to compete with China, is something that has been underway for a long time. It's manifesting itself now, as you say, with these supply chain dependencies. But it really does constitute an act of war against our country. And it's not been regarded as such to this point. I think Donald Trump sort of was moving in that direction before, you know, I personally believe the Chinese helped, you know, topple him from power and among other ways, this COVID-19 exercise. But this piece of the problem, intellectual property theft, the extent to which, you know, we've been training. Lawrence Sellin does a marvelous job of documenting the extent to which we are continuing to train Chinese, even People's Liberation Army officers in our research institutions in techniques and technologies relevant to their biological warfare ambitions against us. I mean, this is sheer madness, is it not?
Yeah, it's for those of us, I mean, that have been around and remember what the criteria was for security and counterintelligence and keeping a clearance back in the Cold War. I'll give an example. When I was a young officer stationed in Hawaii at the Intelligence Center of the Pacific, I worked in a targeting shop, and there was a lot of Air Force personnel in there. And there was a guy that had arrived. He had been an Air Force captain, and he had been a prior enlisted, and he had been in Germany for most of his tours before he came to Hawaii. And his wife was German, West German. But in the course of they had been married for some time, but in the course of the background check on him, when you have to get a periodic review every 5 years, it came to the government's attention, the Air Force's attention, that his wife's mother had originally been born in East Germany. And they pulled this guy's clearance for just having something that far back that was, and the mother-in-law lived in Hawaii, and she was an older lady, and it was probably overreach. But the point was, is that we paid really strict attention to being penetrated by adversaries. And in the Cold War, we looked at the Soviet Union, we looked at East Germany, and we said, they stand against our values. They want to hurt us. They're trying to promote a global communist revolution that will overthrow America. And we took that seriously. And now we have, we have reports from both sides of the aisle. It's not a partisan thing. Clearly, when the commander-in-chief's got lots of issues, like Peter Schweitzer's new book, Red Handed. I mean, it's very clear that both sides of the aisle have been compromised. And the fact that some researcher like this could write this book with those source material, not just wild allegations, but source material, and that not cause for an independent investigation into what's going on nationally, we're in serious problems. It's much like old Rome where, you know, people were so decadent that they didn't even care anymore. They just wanted to, you know, pass the wine and let me go to my next orgy. I mean, this is kind of where we're at.
Bread and circuses. Yeah. Jim, let me just drill down on this particular point, though, if I could. Isn't it still the case, at least on the books, that if you are somewhere below the president in the food chain, if you will, you're still held to some of those higher standards? I mean, if an enlisted man or a junior officer were to be found to have these kinds of compromises, would they not be, subject to, well, criminal prosecution, quite possibly?
Yeah, there's those requirements and regulations are still on the book for, at least in the Department of Defense. I suspect it's for the entire government writ large, that if you're working for the U.S. government and you're receiving payment from a foreign entity, even an allied foreign entity, you can be in trouble for that. You can lose your career. You can lose your clearance. You can, in some cases, depending on how you do it, like Charles Lieber, the professor out of Harvard there, you can go to jail. And so the fact that we have senior people in our government that seem to be above the law, outside of the norms, because they're something different, this is not American. That's the fundamental issue. And I want to get back one thing. You know, we talked about the Putin G statement at the beginning. What the most important thing about that statement, you know, we can quibble about all the military linkages and all of that, but what we can't quibble on is that was a statement of ideological alignment between these two countries. And we are facing an ideology that says we want to overturn Western liberal democracy and freedom and liberty and everything that America stood for. That's what they want to attack, and they're attacking it across all fronts, especially in our culture and our information warfare.
Right, and quite possibly in the near future, militarily as well. And Jim, this is such an important point, and I'm so glad you came back to it, because I mentioned in my opening comment about it that it was an extremely cynical document. And one of the things right out of the gate was they profess this commitment to human rights and democracy. And what you just said is perfectly clear on this point. It's a very different concept of the rights that individuals have and the freedoms that we take for granted in this country, and they will not be protected if this axis comes to power as they aspire to worldwide. And we've just been discussing how the Chinese are making great headway in that direction, and the Russians are indeed going to be helping them do so. Jim, let me just ask you a further question about this sort of macro picture. What does it mean in your personal experience in the United States military if the rank and file are held to one set of standards and the senior commanders, political or, you know, military for that matter, are held to a different set? Is it conducive to good order and discipline, to unit cohesion, to readiness, let alone to the deterrence that we need our military to constitute, or not so much?
Now, Frank, this kind of two-tiered level of justice is devastating to morale and to combat effectiveness. And this general, retired Marine Corps General Newbold, wrote this essay here over the last 24 hours. It's detrimental to our prime function as a military, which is lethality. You have a military for one purpose and one purpose only, and that's to kill the enemy. And when we create these kind of fissures through Well, the senior commanders don't get held to the same standards as the junior personnel. That creates fissures. It detracts from our lethality. It brings in doubt and uncertainty. We're doing more with this diversity, equity, and inclusion nonsense that's being forced into the DoD. We are destroying our lethality of our combat forces by dividing us instead of, as I think the general put in his essay, the military is uniform. You wear a uniform because everybody is on the same team and they're working towards the same goal. And when we take these Marxist, Leninist, communist mindset, which says we're going to make everybody an individual and separate them and break them down, that destroys the that destroys the power of the military. And it's perverse because they promote this individualism. Like you said, that statement talked about human rights and individualism. But in reality, we know at the end of the day, the communism is about collective actions and collective responsibility and collective guilt. And true individual freedom is never recognized and
to the contrary, it's crushed. It's a threat to the system, and it cannot be tolerated. And Jim, this is the thing that I just bear with me 1 second. I just have to take this call quickly. Stand by. I'm sorry, Jim. I just want to make sort of in closing a point that I think hopefully is going to inspire our listeners who understandably would find a lot of this information that you've shared with us depressing. I sense, and I've been spending the past 24 hours with some distinguished military retirees out here in Colorado, Major General Joe Arbuckle, who has stood up a group called Flag Officers for America, and a team led by former Lieutenant General Rod Bishop, called Stand Against Racism and Radicalism in the Services, also known as STARS. These are people who are coming forward, Jim Fennell, as you do, speaking truthfully about the challenges that we're facing and using the authority that comes of their command experience, which is impressive to say the least, to rally our people to ensure that there are course corrections made, to use a nautical term, before the ship is fully on the rocks. And it's certainly headed there at the moment, I think, if it's not beginning to breach. Let me just say, one of the things that I'm particularly heartened by, in addition to that, is that it seems as though and in a way, it's epitomized by this young skier by the name of Eileen Gu, who took full advantage, being raised in America and a competitor in the American sports system, to train with and presumably for Team USA. Only, and I don't know this has been established, but I suspect has been compensated handsomely by the Chinese Communist Party to go over to play for their team, literally, and win the gold medal, in fact, in one of her skiing events and maybe some others. But Jim Fennell, the point is that I think she's not the only one playing for the other team. And we've talked about others. I sense people in this country are beginning to respond with both horror at that behavior, the anti-American character of it, and now I think increasingly going to be holding such people accountable. I certainly hope so, and we're going to do everything we can at the Committee on the Present Danger of China to encourage that, as our friends of ours at Victims of Communism and in the, you mentioned Peter Schweitzer with his new book and the Coalition for Prosperous America, the consumers research, there's a team that is now in the field helping to clarify just how egregious this practice is of selling out our country maybe for the proverbial 20 silver coins, but for whatever it is unacceptable. And I'm hopeful, Jim Fennell, that with the leadership of people like yourself making clear why we must not tolerate such behavior, we're going to see that, as I say, course correction affected. A closing comment from you, sir, very quickly.
Yeah, Frank, I agree. I think with what we're seeing up in Canada, there's a seems to be a resurgence of people remembering Edmund Burke's word that evil flourishes when good people do nothing. And we've been cajoled into thinking that there's nothing that we can do. And I think it's time that, and we're starting to see it, as you mentioned, that people are really starting to wake up and say, this is really wrong. And we're all just normal Americans, and we're not the racists and all these things we're accused of. And we need to get our country back and say no to these woke Marxist ideology that's sweeping the nation that came from China.
Amen. And is being wielded against us by the Chinese Communist Party, among others. Jim Fennell, we have to leave it at that. Thank you so much for your time. Thank you for your extraordinary and continuing service to our country. I know you'll keep it up, and I hope you come back to us with updates very soon. Thanks to the rest of you for joining us. I hope you'll do the same again on Monday. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
This is Frank Gaffney, and this is my take. Is House Speaker Nancy Pelosi auditioning for her next gig? If so, her recent behavior suggests that she has her sights set on the role of our time's Tokyo Rose, the voice of collaboration with our mortal enemy, namely the Chinese Communist Party. After all, her warning to America's Olympians not to anger the ruthless Chinese Communist regime was unnecessary for anyone now in the genocide games totalitarian bubble. They're under no illusion about the police state in which they are competing and that they are legitimating by doing so. Rather, Mrs. Pelosi seems to be trying to impress on the rest of us that the CCP's rise is inevitable and that resistance to it is dangerously futile. This appalling performance, however, may be a function not of her future aspirations, but of her past compromise. As Peter Schweitzer reports in his superb new book, Red Handed, How American Elites Get Rich Helping China Win. During her time in Congress, Mrs. Pelosi's husband has earned many tens of millions of dollars in Chinese government-approved deals. The trouble is that Beijing Nancy's currently the third in line to the presidency. Worse yet, the two people north of her in the constitutional food chain are a commander-in-chief long ago bought by the CCP and a vice president notorious for her Marxist ideological zeal. It's hard to overstate the dire implications of such treachery at this particular moment. The new axis declared last week by China's Führer, Xi Jinping, and his Mussolini, Vladimir Putin, poses the greatest threat to the free world since the Nazi-Soviet Non-Aggression Pact of 1939. Quite apart from the devastating effect of the Biden wrecking operation's ignominious Afghan collapse, the CCP and our other ruthless enemies around the world, from Iran to Pakistan to North Korea to the Marxists now dominating Latin America, have all been empowered and emboldened by this nation's takedown by their allies and enablers inside the United States. Perhaps such foes will refrain from exploiting this opportunity until November, when we have a chance for a major course correction. We should not plan on such a hope, however. Instead, we must bend every effort to deterring the incipient aggression clearly being prepared and telegraphed by the new Axis and its comrades. That must begin with publicly repudiating Beijing Nancy and the others among our elites captured by and working for our truly ruthless enemies. Learn more at securefreedom.org.
This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. What is Vladimir Putin thinking? That question is on many minds around the world, including notably in Ukraine, the nation facing the prospect of imminent invasion by the army and naval forces the Russian leader now has encircling it. Ditto the Western civilian and military officials feverishly consulting about this crisis. Whatever Putin is planning to do, two factors probably loom large. His communist Chinese allies have his back, and Joe Biden is making clear that Ukraine is on its own, and that Americans there should get out immediately. If those considerations prompt Putin to exercise at least a combination of paramilitary, cyber attacks, and psychological operations he calls hybrid warfare to force Ukraine's submission once more to the Kremlin's domination, we will look back with regret at our failure to fracture the emerging Russo-Chinese alliance and deter its aggression against free Ukraine. This is Frank Affney.
I'm Robert Muse, co-founder of the American Freedom Law Center, a national public interest law firm that fights for faith and freedom in federal and state courts across the country. Make no mistake, we are living in dangerous times. Left-wing progressives in government are assaulting our Constitution like no other time in the history of our great nation. Indeed, we hear politicians at the highest levels of government and a major political party espousing what they believe to be the benefits of socialism and the unrestrained growth of the federal government. Fortunately, our Constitution was designed to prevent tyranny and to protect liberty. It enshrines fundamental freedoms in the Bill of Rights, which was designed as a brake on the power of government. In short, our Constitution was designed to protect private citizens like you and me from the tyranny of government. I can assure you that the American Freedom Law Center will do its part to hold tyrannical government officials accountable in our courts of law so that we, the people, remain a free people. You can support the important work of the American Freedom Law Center with a tax-deductible donation. Please visit our website at www.americanfreedomlawcenter.org.
History was made on today's date. Stay tuned for an American Minute with Bill Federer.
On February 11, 1861, newly elected President Abraham Lincoln delivered a farewell speech in Springfield, Illinois, as he left for Washington, D.C. Lincoln stated, "I now leave, not knowing when or whether I may return, with a task before me greater than that which rested upon Washington." Abraham Lincoln continued, "Without the assistance of that divine being who ever attended him, I cannot succeed. With that assistance, I cannot fail. Trusting in him who can go with me and remain with you and be everywhere for good, let us confidently hope that all will yet be well."
This has been an American Minute with Bill Federer. For a free transcript, call American Minute at 1-888-USA-WORD.